and welcome to the first episode of Rugby League Rookwood, the show where we dig up some of the great stories from the game's past. My name is Matt Hunt, and I shall be your host, but the man to guide us through our time travels is Rugby League historian Terry Williams, the Doris Stokes of Rugby League. Welcome, Terry. Now, just explain how the show came about and what you want to cover.
Yeah, g'day, Matt. Well, there are so many wonderful stories that have been forgotten, so many treasures from the game's past that deserve to be dug up and shared again with fans of the game. The full human spectrum and triumph and tragedy, heroes and villains, humour and drama and controversy, they're all mixed up and they're so rich that, they, as I said, it's too good not to share.
You convince me. And what about Rookwood? Why the name Rookwood? For our millions of overseas listeners, what's the significance of Rookwood?
Well, Rookwood is the necropolis in Sydney, so it's the biggest cemetery in the Southern Hemisphere. It's over at Lidcombe, just near Lidcombe Oval, and was actually the name of the suburb until the locals got sick of being associated with dead people, and they wanted the name changed, so it became Lidcombe. Mind you, I don't know why people would complain about the association with the dead. I certainly prefer the company of the dead, or the living impaired, as I prefer to call them, than some of the brain-dead people I've been unfortunate enough to meet along the journey.
Well, you don't have to be brain-dead to listen to this show. As a matter of fact, it'll expand your brain because you're going to learn a lot, let me tell you. Anyway, where are we off to this week, Terry? Let's fire up that time machine.
Yeah, I think we might go back to 1911 to talk about a fellow called Robert Nicholson. One of the themes that we come across again and again in our discussions that will take place on the show is that everything old is new again, but I don't know if anything is really quite as bizarre and matches this one. So Robert Harding Nicholson was born up in Taree in 1880. He was the second of six children to Robert James Nicholson and his wife Harriet. And he grew up in the Manning area and was a labourer. And his life changed forever in about 1897 when he was 17. And he married a young lady up there called Alice May Wootton. And given the fact that they're both teenagers, one suspects that she may have been pregnant. And that is certainly almost confirmed by the fact that she gave birth to their first child the following year. So 1898, and there were three more children that would follow, all boys. And by the time the third of those, Cecil, was born in 1909, they're living in Newcastle. So he's moved to Newcastle and was playing rugby union in 1907 with the local club South Newcastle up there. And then in 1908, when rugby league commences, the club competition, Newcastle is one of the clubs to join. So he throws in his lot with the boys from up there, which include the likes of Stan Carpenter, Bill Bailey, Nimmo Walsh, etc. And he does fair enough in that first season to obviously draw a bit of interest. So in 1909, he moves to Queensland and becomes part of the fledgling Brisbane competition, because that's in its first year. In 1908, when Queensland took part in the Interstate Series, they didn't actually have a club competition behind them, which would have made it very, very difficult. So anyway, Nicholson's up there in 1909, and straight away he's picked for Queensland Possibles and Probables in a trial, and then represents the state against New Zealand and against New South Wales, and he's also picked for Australia in the Test match in Brisbane. In those days, it was usual to include a couple of locals, Queensland, maybe not so much on merit, but certainly to help foster the game. And Nicholson was one of three players who was selected for Australia as they won that test match up there against the Kiwis. And he follows it up in 1910 by being selected for Australia again, Queensland and Australia again, against the Great Britain side that was led by James Lomas, the first British Lions that came down under. So, you know, obviously he's a bit of a local star, but before the 1911 season starts, his fortunes take a little bit of a turn for the worse, because whilst he's been in Brisbane, he's been either working for tax purposes or he's using the alias of Alfred Nichols off the field. Whenever he's picked, he's always listed as Nicholson in the papers. But off the field, he goes by Alf Nichols. And Alf Nichols has married a local girl up there, and this causes him a little bit of a problem when it comes to light, so he's charged by the courts with bigamy and desertion of his family down here and has to appear. His defence was that he thought his wife, Alice, in Sydney, had passed away at the time. That argument sort of doesn't stack up when it's pointed out that she'd actually borne him a child during his time in Brisbane when he'd been coming back here to play representative football, etc. So there's a little bit of a problem there straight away. So he's sentenced to 2 years imprisonment, or to be on bond recognisances of his own good behaviour. So, you know, it's big on parole, basically.
So he's in a bit of a fix here. He's charged with bigamy. The defence is fantastic. You know,
I've never... Slightly flawed, I'd suggest. But
yeah, good barrister mightn't, barrister as good as they might be, mightn't get you off that one. Yeah, particularly when the wife is still alive. And a busy man.
Obviously.
A very busy man. And in between all this, he's still fitting in a flourishing rugby league career.
Yeah. So he's Australian player, test number 47 on the register from his games in 1909. So in 1911, he appears for Queensland again, even though the court case has been heard. And there was a tri-series that year against New Zealand and New South Wales, because ahead of the Kangaroo Tour that was scheduled to take place, the second Kangaroo Tour, there were four Kiwis included, so it was going to be an Australasian team. Mm. When they come to select the team, it's selected in waves, which is a bit unusual, I suppose, to what we'd recognise today.
Yeah, so today we have the train-on squads for State of Origin and even Australian teams, and they might select, say, 23, 25, 30 players in the one go. That's not the case back then.
No, and the Premiership's still in swing because they've got to sail away. Obviously, they're going by boat. So they have to leave well before the Premiership is decided. So the selection, as I say, is announced in waves, and that gave the selectors and the players, I suppose, some flexibility, because if a player was unavailable, then they could have time to find his replacement, you know, and fill in the gap, whether it was a centre or a hooker or whatever.
And, of course, we're talking about a time when players are working, so that would greatly affect their availability.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons that Dally Messenger, for example, was selected for this tour, and he decided that having gone with the New Zealanders in 1907-08 and having gone with the Kangaroos in 1908-09 and being only married a couple of years, that he would stay at home. Then his business interests here with his wife Annie would preclude him taking part. So he was one of those who declined. So was Sandy Pearce. Mm. And the other one who didn't decline but whose selection was not endorsed was our mate Robert Harding Nicholson. So the New South Wales Rugby League, which was putting up the money for the tour, I mean, Queensland and New Zealand didn't have two bob between them, basically. And the New South Wales Rugby League was flying after the visit of the Englishmen in 1910. They made an absolute bundle of money. So they were putting up the cash, and obviously they wanted the final say in who goes, and Nicholson's not picked.
Bob's not endorsed by the management committee.
Yeah,
is there a reason why?
Obviously, the bigamy and the charges, the elephant in the room, but that's never mentioned in any of the papers, which is amazing, you know, and it just says that on merit, they thought he may have deserved selection, but they thought that at least one of the other Queenslanders, particularly Woodhead and McGregor, the fullback, Woodhead, who was a centre or winger, thought they should have been selected. And it's got to be said that in terms of fostering the game and trying to develop the game in Queensland, it's a pretty poor way to treat one of your partners, a junior partner at that, and would certainly give rise to a lot of the Queensland conspiracy theories that abound in the 21st century. But
so in these early days, we're even seeing a little bit of politics happening in representative teams.
Well, it's ever been thus, I'd suggest.
That's right, exactly.
So, yeah, he's not endorsed, and in 1912 he plays his final game for Queensland. They get touched up again by New South Wales, 65-9, and that was the same score as the year before, so remarkably. So after that first game, the Queensland selectors decide to put a broom basically through the team and make some wholesale changes, including Nicholson. So in 1913 he comes back to New South Wales and attempts to reunite with Alice. Obviously the relationship in Brisbane has ended rather abruptly. And he bobs up in 1914, so to speak, playing for North Sydney. Alongside, there was a fellow Queenslander called George Duffin who came down and played with North Sydney after being in the Queensland teams alongside Nicholson. And Duffin went on to be killed during the First World War. But Nicholson, 1914, is his swan song of footy pretty much. And again, there's no great money in it. He hasn't made a quid too much out of the game. And he's 34 years of age by then.
How
so,
old was he? 34,
you know, he's getting a bit long on the tooth, if he had any. So in 1915, he moves back up to the Central Coast towards Newcastle, and he's reported as playing at Wyong briefly and then briefly as a referee. But he doesn't seem to have any more involvement in the game after that. And there's no record of any of his four sons ever having anything to do with the game, so that may have been a little bit poisoned by the whole experience. And he doesn't serve in the war. He basically just remains a labourer for the remainder of his life. In the census, you can see that he and Alice are living together at different times, and then at other times they're not sharing the same abode. So I'd suggest that may mean that the marriage problems were ongoing.
Yep.
Surprise, surprise. Why bite off more than you can chew?
A bit rocky. And I should put a disclaimer in at this point. Terry and I do not condone bigamy.
No. I mean, why would you double your troubles?
Exactly.
I'll cop it for that. But Bob Nicholson dies at the age of 59 in Newcastle, and he's staying with his mother at the time. Alice lives for another 10 years. And then she's buried in the same plot as him. So whether that signifies reconciliation or it was out of financial necessity, I suppose it's like a lot of other things in Bob Nicholson's life. We'll never really know, but...
Bob Nicholson, we salute you. Welcome back to Rugby League Rookwood. Our next segment is something we like to call Quirky Corner. Rex had Controversy Corner. We'd like to have a look at some issues of the game in its history where a little bit, well, a little bit left of centre, a little bit quirky. That's the best way to describe it. So what are we going to do today, Terry? What are we going to look at?
We're going to use a few articles from way back to give us an insight into the game as it was in olden times. So we're going to start today with Ray Steer's Diet for Newtown from the Daily Telegraph in 1954. So, Matt, I'll get you to read this one.
Ray Steer, absolute legend of the game. But as I read this out, you might just want to think about his nutritional advice to league players of the day. So this headline is Daily Telegraph, Thursday, 8th of April, 1954. Newtown, league men to go on strict diet. Newtown rugby league players this week will follow a strict diet. They will do so in preparation for next Saturday's match against South Sydney. The game will be their rugby league match of the day at Sydney Cricket Ground. Former international Ray Steer has suggested the diet. Steer has been invited to assist in coaching the Newtown forwards. He said, "I want the Newtown players to dry out on Friday and Saturday." The proposed Newtown diet made the late Todd Morgan one of the best conditioned performers in boxing. Steer wants the players to eat fillet or T-bone steak and dry toast for their main meals on Thursday and Friday. Very specific there. They will have their final meal of steak and toast at 10 a.m. on Saturday. Steer says the players can have 3 cups of tea on Friday, but must limit themselves to 1 drink on Saturday. He said some of the players may develop a thirst at their work. Subheading, on the wagon. A thin slice of lemon on the tongue will bring relief. Steer and captain coach Cole Gielan will ask the players to go on the wagon until after next Saturday's match. The Newtown players also will be asked to return to bed after a short walk after breakfast on Saturday. They've been asked to report to the dressing room at 2 o'clock and not to stand while watching the early matches. Newtown players will have the choice of sugar-soaked pineapple or glucose as a halftime refresher. Newtown Secretary George Debman said last night the players would not, got to stress that, they would not use vitality pills in their training. So, let's bring a 2024 expression to 1954. Let's unpack this article. There is a lot to unpack. So, Ray Steer wants the players to dry out on Friday and Saturday. Now, what I'm interpreting this is completely 180 to what happens today. Instead of hydrating, you pretty much dehydrate. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I suggest so. It was different time, so it was obviously different training techniques and different dietary techniques. And I think that was still the policy a lot of the time up until about the 60s and 70s, wasn't it, that people would try and limit their fluid intake. You'll get a stitch otherwise.
That's right, yeah, the stitch. Yeah. And you see today, like I was watching a game last night, I forget who it was, kicking for goal. Before he kicked for goal, drink of water. When he got the goal, drink of water.
And then while he's waiting for a kickoff, probably another one.
Yeah, that's right.
Completely different to, in earlier times when the only time you'd get a drink on field was out of the Zambucks with the sponge, you know. And then often when it was a dirty water that had been used to clean someone's knee or abrasion or maybe even under the ribs or in other parts of the body.
I remember when I was about 8 and we all had to get our hepatitis shots because we were drinking from the same sponge in our footy team.
Yeah.
And I still remember that. Now, the reason why this diet, well, we'll get to the diet in a minute, but this whole dehydration aspect is to keep an athlete at his natural weight. So it's obviously aimed at making them feel light.
Well, I suppose even in boxing these days, they dehydrate if they've got to make weight, haven't they? So yeah. It's still a technique that's used. So that's part of the philosophy, I suppose, behind it. But it's accepted practice these days.
Yeah, that's that right.
You don't sort of turn your body into the Sahara Desert because it's not very good for you. As we found out with, you know, we found out with the likes of Danny Shepherd and other heat-related conditions, you know, in the last 30, 40 years. So.
Yep. The diet itself is amazing. So you are very specific to eat a fillet or T-bone steak and dry toast.
White toast.
Dry white toast.
Yep.
For their main meals on Thursday and Friday. So this whole, obviously for the protein with the steak. I'm not, don't know about the dry toast.
Yeah, well, could you have sauce with it? This begs the question, right? does that keep it dry or is it making it too moist?
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah.
The protein, the idea of having protein may have some benefit, but I don't know if on the day of the game you'd be wanting to have a T-bone steak or maybe a nice piece of fillet.
The steak, their last bit of steak is at 10 a.m. and toast. Yes. Steak and toast.
Can you have onions?
On Saturday. exactly. Now, 3 cups of tea on Friday,
mm-hmm.
but must limit themselves to 1 drink on Saturday.
Mm.
I'm assuming that's water.
It could.
I can't imagine him saying you're allowed 1 beer before you go on.
I don't think you're drinking too much before the game in those days. But you
know. Now, these players are going to get thirsty. But if you're a good employer, what you'll provide is you'll provide a thin slice of lemon for each of your players. You should be able to provide lemon wedges for your players because that's going to help bring relief.
And having them available, I think, should be part of the union, the award conditions where the employers are required. I don't know how it works in practice if you're a serving police officer and you've got to stop in the line of duty and say, excuse me, I've just got to have put a piece of lemon on my tongue. I'm getting a little bit thirsty.
I need relief. and these guys too, they're working hard jobs. These guys are labourers. They're working very, very manual jobs, so... Yeah, the lemon on the tongue would bring relief, but very, very difficult. Great if you're working in an orchard, if you're working in a lemon orchard somewhere out the back of Sydney.
Fruit farm.
Yeah, well, there would have been a lot of orchards around Sydney, I guess, around this stage as well. So possibly no shortages of lemon. Then I like this one too. They're going to be asked to return to bed after a short walk after breakfast on Saturday. So they get a lie-in. And then, of course, very scientific, they're not to stand while watching the early matches. So 3 o'clock kickoff, they've got to go to the dressing rooms at 2 o'clock and, you know, rest their legs.
And maybe have some lemon.
And have some more lemon, yeah, that's right. However, at halftime, they must have been looking forward to halftime because you've got the choice, sugar-soaked pineapple or glucose. So one or the other. I'm not sure what the sugar-soaked pineapple would do, I
Again,
guess.
It's just like a glucose hit, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, it is, yeah.
And that's still sort of a little bit of what they do today, but the Gatorade and the likes of Powerade, etc., which weren't invented there, they're only 1970s inventions.
Yeah.
Even Staminade.
Staminade.
It wasn't around back in those days, but any sponsors were available, by the way. they weren't around then, so you know, the idea of having some sort of sugar hit, you know, like, and even now they still
they
have
do.
Things like snakes lollies in the dressing room before and halftime, etc. So
I saw footage once of Cameron Smith in the Melbourne dressing room at halftime drinking a Coke. Don't know how that'd sit on your stomach in the second half. But of course, at the end too, we've got to stress this, all above board this diet, the end part is fantastic. He stresses, the Newtown secretary, George Debman, that they're not going to use vitality pills in their training. I'm not sure what he means by vitality pills. Today that could take on a different sort of context. Any thoughts on that one, Terry?
No, you'd have to ask Stephen Dank, I think. The idea of using supplements certainly abounds in all the stores that support all the weightlifters and bodybuilders around. There's plenty of them around, so maybe there is a place for vitality pills. The other thing that's not mentioned anywhere in that is smoking.
that's right.
In those days, at least half of the team would have been smoking before the game, if not at halftime.
Maybe it was the filtered ones. They were the ones that were good for you, the cigarettes that are good for you. Anyway, what I'm going to do, Terry, I'm going to find a player. I'm going to find probably we won't be able to get an NRL player. I don't want to jeopardise their $1 million contracts by putting them on this diet, but an A-grade player, A reserve player, I'm going to find one and I'm going to do a little experiment. I'm going to put this player on this diet before they have a game in the next couple of weeks And we're going to speak to that player and we're going to see if the diet worked, because the diet actually did work, didn't it?
Well, it finished as 20-all draw this game. It was ahead of the Newtown playing South Sydney early in the season. So, and those two clubs went on to meet again in the grand final. So I don't know if South Sydney were taking vitality pills in the decider, but there was no testing back then.
And the report I read for this match of the day, this one against South, they were commended for playing enterprising football. So you don't need vitality pills to be enterprising, that's for sure. So the man we just spoke about then, Ray Steer, his nutritional advice may be a little bit questionable, but no doubt one of the legends of the game. As a Rooster supporter myself, an East man, I just find the story of Ray Steer fascinating. Youngest man to play first grade, he was just 16. Achieved every honour in the game. He was a renowned hard man, a boxer, a commentator. You name it, Ray did it. Let's talk a little bit more about Ray.
Yeah, well, he was born out in Western New South Wales at Warialda, which is, they don't produce many soft boys, I don't think.
No, shrinking violets out Warialda way, that's for sure, yeah.
Particularly so in the years around when Ray was growing up. So, but he had a bit of a troubled childhood because he had a blood clot on his spine at the age of 8, and they didn't know if he'd live, actually. So he moves to Sydney and gets wrapped in plaster and has to stay in bed pretty much for 12 months, and he still struggled for a few years after that, and the family say that he was actually cured by a Chinese herbalist. So wow. I don't know if there's any vitality pills involved in that, Matt, but he's...
or lemon wedges.
He comes good, obviously, and makes up for it. So he starts playing football at Randwick Boys High School in the mid-20s, and he gets called up to grade when he's about 15, 16 years of age, and plays in a tour match against one of the country teams to start with, and then makes his first grade debut in 1928 in round one at the age of 16. And he's still the youngest ever Rooster to appear for the club. So straight away, he was a bit of a child prodigy. It took him a few years to establish himself in first grade, as you know, you could probably understand. It's the age of 16. The depression's on. There's a lot of hard men around. Yeah. You've got the South Sydney pack, had the likes of Treweek and the O'Connor brothers. And then on the rep scene, you've got the Queenslanders with Steinhort and Madsen and Armbruster. And when you look at the photos of those blokes, you know, they look hard, you know, like... and later on, Frank Curran was another one who was a big fella from South Sydney and a copper as well. And then later on, you've got the likes of Bumper Farrell and, you know, like hard men for a hard year in the depression. So, and the game was beset by violence to a large degree then.
Yeah, it's about intimidation.
Yeah.
Well, particularly in the forwards.
Absolutely. And when you're playing for a winning bonus, and that's what determines how much you're going to get, then being able to nullify the opposition's strengths, particularly in the area of scrummaging, because that was the battle for possession and there were so many more scrums than there are these days. I mean, these days, scrums are just a chance for blokes to cuddle each other and have a bit of a rest.
Yeah. Well, back then it was a legitimate contest. Oh, some of the things that happened in the scrums, when you speak to those old guys, those old players, about the tricks they used to do in the scrums, putting garlic on their face and smearing it against the opposition prop, it's horrific.
And the scrum count in those games was, you know, up towards 50 a game. Yeah. So you certainly earned your money. They were called the pigs a lot of the time, and the backs were looked on as the racehorses and thoroughbreds. But it was the guys up front who would determine a lot of the time whether you were going to win the game, you know, win the ball and win the game.
And this is just amazing. He's doing this at the age of 16 after that early onset of illness.
Yeah. So by about 1930, he establishes himself with the Roosters. And then it's a good time to do so because they're just about to enter a golden period. You've got some other wonderful young players coming through, the likes of Dave Brown when he still had hair. Other guys who would feature in that team, mighty team they assembled in the 1930s. So the likes of Sid Joe Pearce, who was Sandy Pearce's son. Harry Pearce, no relation to the others, and a different spelling. Andy Norval was a lock. Viv Thickness, Ross McKinnon, etc., etc. Even Jack Coote, Ron Coote's father, was one of the fringe members of that team, but he was flat getting a look in with all that talent in front of him.
This is a golden era for the for the tricolours, as they were then.
Yeah, so they made the semis just about every year. It's not until 1935, though, that it clicks for them when they win the premiership then. And then they win three in a row. Yeah. 35, 36, 37, and, you know, have a mighty team. And then they win again a couple more times during Ray's career there. But, yeah, that team of 36, 37 was an unbelievable side. And I think there were eight of them actually selected for the 1937-38 tour, but only seven got to go because Fred Toddy, the winger, broke his ankle early on. So
Ray's blessed to be amongst that.
And, you know, he's the leader of the pack in every which way for them. Right. Yeah. And he's got the approach of, you know, take no prisoners and cop no shit from anyone, and even a little bit of Noel Kelly's famous retaliate first, you know. Like,
retaliate
first. And he did that on the club scene and on the representative scene too. Yeah. So most famously, I suppose, in 1936 in the Ashes series against Great Britain, he and Jim Arkwright, the British prop, were both sent off in the first test and the third test. And Australia won the first test quite comfortably, 24-6, I think it was, and everyone patting Ray on the back and saying, well done, mate, you took him out, you know, as well. When he tried it on again in the third test and Arkwright cleaned him up, he didn't look so good. Ray had to be helped off the field. He always said that he was acting, but a lot of people said, I don't know if that was the truth. Yeah. But as Ian Head said in his wonderful book about the Roosters, he said Ray would have looked a lot tougher and smarter if Australia had won the game and the Ashes. Yes. But it wasn't to be, and they didn't win the Ashes at all during his time wearing the green and gold. But two kangaroo tours for Australia. And he was no mere biff merchant either. You know, like in 1936, it might have even been the premiership final, I think, he ended up scoring what was considered the try of the year. And the ball went through about 80 metres, covered about 80 metres and through about 7 or 8 sets of hands. But he was the one backing up at the end, you know, of this marvellous flowing movement. Mm. And that just speaks to his athleticism and skill, I suppose.
His mobility.
Yeah. So, and he was obviously the leader of men because... later on, he becomes the captain and coach.
So he's a champion on the field, great player, one of the Roosters legends. But it's really off the field as well that really needs to be spoken about with Ray, because he was involved in everything.
Yeah, well, he had a pedigree that went all the way back to 1908, because he married the daughter of Wally Webb. Mm. And Wally Webb had been one of the pioneer Roosters, or tricolours as they were back then, and then later served a stint as both secretary and as president of the club after being a player. And he was the manager of the 1933 Kangaroo Tour, which Ray went on. Ray hadn't married Wally's daughter, Gwen, her name was. At that stage, they married about 1938, but he must have got on well with the manager and kept in his good books. Again, Wally Webb had great pedigree and connections as well, because he was the uncle of Jack Fingleton, the famous cricketer who opened the batting for Australia during the Bodyline series and was a fine player in his own right during the Bradman era, and later became a prolific political and cricket writer. More political than cricket, but cricket was obviously something that he was very good at and wrote about passionately. But yeah, so Fingleton and Steer are all part of this Wally Webb connection, and there's a real connection there. And that may have helped him at times, because he clashed notoriously with Jersey Flegg.
He seems to be the sort of guy that called a spade a shovel.
A bloody shovel, I suggest, for want of a better expletive. The approach that he took on the field was pretty much the same off the field. He was just full on and, you know, my way or the highway a lot of the time, but not as blustering or as pugnacious perhaps as Rex could be. You know, like,
but he had a touch of, he did only
have,
one Rex.
He did have a touch of the Rex about him. So
I don't know about Ray. I don't know if Ray, you know, made a citizen's arrest on any nudist bathers near his house.
No, although he did serve as a policeman at one stage, so...
Did he? He was a policeman as well.
Yeah, as well. Ray and Flegg, a lot of it goes back to, I think it was before the 1940 final, when Flegg had wanted to bring Arthur Fadden into the dressing room before the game. And Steer had a policy of only the club president, secretary and the trainer could come in, apart from the players. And so when the doorman says, oh, Mr. Flegg, who was the president of the New South Wales League, and obviously a distinguished former Eastern Suburbs player, the first captain of the club, wants to bring him in, and Steve said no. He said, I'm not having him big noting himself, you know, we're here. After the game, they'd be more than welcome. So after the game, Flegg comes in and he's fuming, you'll never play on the cricket ground again. And Steve just goes, what, are you running the joint now, are you? And Flegg never did get on the SCG Trust, by the way. And he explained the situation to Fadden, who understood completely, you know, that the players wanted to be preparing for the game and the Roosters won, so... But Flegg and Steer clashed repeatedly after that, pretty much up until Flegg died in the early 1960s. So Steer would berate him through the media and calling the board of no control and say he was a silly old fool, and point out, particularly with some of the things that went on, like the 1953 American All-Stars farce that took place, and then the 1954 abandoned game where the referee walks off after, you know, with
it was Great Britain, New South Wales.
And All Boxford was the referee. And the inquiry was just swept under the carpet very quickly, as they did with a lot of things back then, you know, like... So
feuds in rugby league. Always been a part of the game, yeah.
But Steve, he had the profile, as you say, you know, he was doing all sorts of things. So he was in the media, he was writing, and then later on he became one of the first TV commentators, and he has his own show on Channel 9 for about 5 years on game days where he'd preview games and do reviews, et cetera, et cetera. I'd love to see some of
that. Oh, that'd be fantastic. Wouldn't that be great?
But he also was served a long stint as Eastern Suburbs Club president. Mm. He served as coach for country teams and for the Roosters, and even had two seasons at Manly in 1947-48 when they started. I don't know what was going on there. He must have had
He was a nutritionist for Newtown.
For Newtown as well. For hire, I think, because he helped a lot of other clubs. You read media reports at the time. And a lot of clubs would bring him in as a forwards coach because obviously he was recognised as the generalissimo of forward play. And
he got into boxing too.
Yeah, he took on Herb Narvo. Not a smart move, taking on Herb Narvo. And there was only one way that was going to finish. But yeah, look, he fancied himself and had enough gumption to get in the inside the ropes against Herb. But good luck with that. Also worked as one of the first player scouts for English clubs. So before the transfer ban after the war, he lined up for Trevor Allen and Rex Mossop to go from rugby union over to the Lee club in England. He was acting as a scout for them. And I'm sure he got a sling for that too. I think
he's really ahead of his time in a lot of things. He's basically a player manager.
Yeah, in some ways, but only doing it, you know, like here and there. He also helped organise players for country clubs. So if guys from the city wanted to go to country clubs, he'd help facilitate that sort of stuff too. Most famously, when Clive Churchill signed a contract with Illawarra that he then backed out of and was going to go down and play in Wollongong. And then that was about 53, and Churchill got cold feet and then stayed at South Sydney for another 5 or 6 years. But apart from Trevor Allen and Rex Mossop that he sent over, there were a couple of guys from the Eastern Suburbs Juniors who went over there. Keith Giddos was one, Tony Paskins was one, and Rupert Mudge was another. And they all had wonderful careers in England. And Giddos came back to be involved with the New South Wales Rugby League for many years as an administrator as well.
You can tell we're talking about a different era here. Terry just said Eastern Suburbs Juniors.
Yes, there was such a thing once upon a time.
His media career with rugby league, you mentioned he had the sports show, but he was the commentator?
Yes, yeah, as well. So controversial and forthright, as you'd expect.
He was Rex before Rex.
Yes, yeah.
And as a Rooster supporter, East supporter, what I like about Ray and what he really should be known for, he came up with the expression, East to win.
Yeah. Well, he was a passionate East man, you know, and he supported things like the change in jersey design, which was based obviously on the French team, even though that came from Wally O'Connell and a lot of the players. But he supported that, and he thought the club should move with the time. So, and again, that just brought him into conflict with Flegg. So, he worked for many years after being a policeman. He worked for the United Licensed Victuallers Association, I think it was. So, basically, he had to go around and just check on that they were buying their spirits. So he, etc. And not a bad job going to visit pubs in the days before random breath testing.
And we saw a photo the other day of him at the Dolphin. Yes. Surrey Hills there, taken in the 80s.
Yeah, it would have been just before he died, I'd say. So Bumper Farrell's there, and Bumper dies in about 85, I think, as well. So Bumper's got a cigarette and a half-empty beer glass in his hand. Keith Holman, who doesn't drink, is holding Ray's glass while Ray is holding some little pussycat there. I don't know if it was the house cat or it's just a metaphor for what he was going to do if he got his hands on.
Even in their elderly years, those men in that photo, I'm sure people just left them alone.
They all had smiles on their faces, which is good to see too.
Anyway, thanks, Terry. That's fantastic. Ray Steer, what a man, what a player, what a legend.
Good on you, Ray.
We're going to end our pioneering episode of Rugby League Rookwood with our feature games. Today, it's the 1907 New South Wales versus New Zealand clashes that established the code in Australia. As Julie Andrews said in The Sound of Music, let's start at the very beginning.
Well, that's a very good place to start, mate. It all goes back, I suppose, to about 1895, if not before, but that 1895 marks the start of rugby league in England when they broke away from the amateur game. And then there's a series of events leading up to 1907 that really accelerate the situation here in Australia. So 1905, the first All Black Tour takes place of England, and The Kiwis go over there, the amateur All Blacks go over there, and they see that there is another game of rugby being played in the north of England, and a lot of them are the best footballers, and they're getting paid to play rugby, whereas the Kiwis, New Zealanders, are on the bare pittance. A lot of them have had to forsake jobs, and it costs them financially to go on the tour, even though they win fame and for their country, and they also brought back a fortune, but they weren't entitled to a cent of it under the amateur rules that were imposed by the international body at the time. So the manager got a big bonus.
I was going to say, where's that money going then?
It goes into the coffers of the New Zealand Rugby Union.
Coffers in a
central revenue, I think they call it.
Right, yeah. Wow.
So obviously the players then think, well, hang on, we should be getting some of the money if we're generating this revenue. And that sentiment was very much in Australian cricket, which is why the Australian cricketers had always controlled their own tours of England from 1878 when they first went over. They were the ones who put together the money to pay for them their own enterprise to go over, and they reaped the benefits, financial benefits of the tour. So it was everyone in and everyone gets their fair share. So, for example, when Victor Trumpel went in 1899, he was originally only going to get a half share because he was the last minute addition to the squad. Mm. But within three games in England, they went, oh, actually, this guy is going to be pretty important. We're going to give him the full whack.
Yep.
And cricket is very much important in what's going on here, because in 1906, you've got the first attempt here to centralise control and set up an Australian cricket board. There had been one earlier incarnation in the 1890s, but got nowhere. So in 1906, guys like Ernie Bean and Billy McAlone in Sydney, they really start to get their hooks into taking control of Australian cricket, and particularly the tours overseas, because that's where the money was. Yeah. A lot of the time here, the grounds that and the association, local bodies, they were just getting the benefits. So Sydney would do well if out of their test matches.
Yep.
Melbourne would do well out of their test matches. Adelaide would get one test match, and there were no test matches in Brisbane or any other states at that time.
No.
This issue of money and where it goes for players in both cricket and rugby is very much prevalent at the time. So in 1906, after the All Blacks come back to New Zealand, some of them come over to Sydney for representative games, and they meet with some of the Australian footballers who are here, and there's big crowds, and again, the question of where does this money go?
Yeah.
And so the discussion takes place about maybe there should be a professional tour over to England, and we can try and make some of that money ourselves and do like the cricketers do, because the Australian cricketers have done very well financially out of the tours. So when the New Zealanders decide that they're going to go, and that's down to largely down to Albert Henry Baskerville and George Smith, the great All Black, and who was also a noted runner, hurdler, even a jockey at one time. So George Smith is in Auckland, Baskerville's in Wellington. They are the ones who get it together, and they organise the team, get a lot of opposition in trying to do so, but they manage to secure a couple of that famous 1905 team, All Black team. And they're going to England, and on the way, the likes of James Giltland and Vic Trumper and Henry Hoyle, Peter Moyer, Alec Burden, etc., they're all meeting around in Trumper's Market Street sports store, which is now where the entrance to David Jones is there. And they say, why don't we get a team together to meet these blokes, and we start our own professional rugby show. So, and the fact that Trumper and Giltland are involved, they know each other through cricket, just again underlines the link between the two sports at that time. Anyway, so they're coming over. They managed to get together. The reports say it was 100 footballers who had put their name down. Only 20 are selected to try out. Two of those then drop out after the team photo's taken, which caused a few problems when Darb Hickey, one of those, is later selected for the Wallaby Tour. But when he goes over there and they go, weren't you? And he goes, no, that was my brother. He said it was his brother who was picked. Must have been his twin brother. But anyway. But anyway, so the New South Wales team for the first game is selected. And it should be pointed out, these three games they played in New South Wales were played under rugby union rules, because no one had seen the new play the ball had only been introduced in 1906 in England, and the game had had only been reduced from 15 to 13. And one of the main problems they had was securing a ground initially, because they wanted to get one in the Moore Park area. You really needed one there if you were going to generate the income that you wanted to out of the whole event. And because the other options, the enclosed grounds like Burstgrave and Wentworth, were too far from the city, and people are working on a Saturday morning as well. So it had to be somewhere that was central enough for them to be able to get to.
So at Moore Park, we've got back then, we've got Sydney Sports Ground.
Yep.
We've got the SCG.
Number one and two.
We got number two, yes, that's right, SCG number two. And we've got the RAS Showground.
Showground down the end. And most of the rugby union matches were being played at the cricket ground for the real big games, or the sports ground as well for club games as well. The showground wasn't getting much of a look in. And so two of the officials there, Monty Soma and Frank Harran, they decided that there might be an opportunity. And when Gilton approached them, they thought, yeah, well, if we play our cards right here and this thing works, we're going to be able to get some guaranteed revenue. And that was the attraction for them. It wasn't so much about supporting the rugby league. So they take the chance to support them, and all of a sudden they've got the venue they want, and there's over 20,000 people can turn up for the first game.
So this New Zealand team, they're on their way to England.
Yep.
Now, that would affect the schedule for these games because they play three games in a week.
Yeah, so they play Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday. Because you've got the half holiday on Saturday afternoon and then Wednesday afternoon. But the Wednesday afternoon, you know, not all jobs have that half holiday. So it's a bit more difficult for some people and to get to watch a game. So for midweek games, it was always going to be a lesser fixture. And you saw that in touring schedules, you know, up until the 1990s when you had the Emus and the Kangaroos. Yeah. So the main fixture would always be on the weekend, Saturday or the Sunday, but then the midweek fixture would be when the second stringers or
would get a run. But 20,000 to the first game at the showground, that would have been crowded. And that's a great start. That's a big crowd to start off.
Yeah, and as I say, all three of these games are played under rugby union. So the New South Wales team for that first game, Matt, you can read the honour roll there, and I'll just throw in a little bit about each of them.
We've got Headley.
Charlie Headley, yeah, from Newcastle, was a great fullback who later came down and played in Sydney.
Stunts.
John Stunts scored four tries for the Roosters in their first ever premiership game and later killed in action on the Western Front.
Which I've been to his plaque there at Valier Bretonneux Memorial and actually laid a Rooster scarf in memory of him. About 2 years ago I did that. Fry.
Son Fry was one of the South Sydney pioneers, one of the five blokes who started that club.
Some guy called Messenger.
Yeah, better known as Dally rather than Herbert Henry.
Yeah.
But securing him was the key to Gilton's success in getting the other players because he was the biggest name in rugby union ranks at the time. And all the rugby union guys had told Gilton, and if you want this to succeed, you should try and get Dally. And it was only on their thumbs up of Dally's mother, by all accounts, that Dally was able to participate because, again, he just played footy. It wasn't what he did. He wasn't, you know, like a huge fanatic of the game at that time. And in fact, he'd only been playing rugby union for about 3 or 4 years because he, you know, as a kid, he did other things, you know, played park footy with his mates or was sailing because they came from a noted boating family and they were down by the harbour and had the boat building business.
Yeah. You can actually still go to his house today and there's a plaque there, Double Bay there. Cheadle.
Yeah, Frank Treadle, Newtown pioneer, and he was reportedly the first player to actually sign with the New South Wales Rugby League when Gilton were recruiting the players. And again, like his other winger in the team, Stunts, he died in action on the Western Front during the First World War, unfortunately.
Rosenfeld?
Yeah, Albie Rosenfeld was one of the great Roosters players to start with. And after the first Kangaroo tour, he met up with a local lass, I think, on tour, and he went back to Huddersfield and starred for them for about 5 years. And they had a wonderful team with the likes of Ben Grenow and Harold Wagstaff, the legendary British centre. Dougie Clark, the world champion wrestler, was in that team too. And they won all four British trophies before the First World War in the 1 year, and regardless of the team of all talents, they were great. And Rosenfeld was, he set try scoring records for them that set marks that Brian Bevan was never able to beat, some of the other wingers, great wingers who were abounded in British football over the years. And they play a lot more games, obviously, but 87 tries or something in a season is just phenomenal.
They played a lot of games, didn't they, back then? They played a stack of games. How do you say this guy's name?
Lou Dalpage.
Lou Dalpage. Easy for you to say. Yeah, that's right.
Lou Dalpage, he was getting towards the end of his footballing career by this stage, and to be quite honest, his brother Jack was probably a better player, but Jack stayed in the union ranks, and then he was killed in action during the First World War, but he became an international in union. Lou's probably most famous, I suppose, for being the grandfather of Blanche Dalpage, who became the second wife of late Prime Minister Bob Hawke. So I did contact Blanche at one stage and share some information about her grandfather with her, because she wasn't didn't know too much about his footballing career, but he played for the Roosters in 1908 and then he made a swan song later on with Annandale when they got going in about 1910. So, and then in the forwards, you've got an eight-man pack here.
You got Hamill.
Yeah, you got Harry Hamill from Newtown, Seven Heads as he was known because he was a hooker.
Hennessy.
Arthur Hennessy, one of the greats, and he was the captain of this team, and he certainly gets his own episode just about because he's one of the great figures in rugby league history that deserves more recognition than he certainly receives.
Mabel?
Bob Mabel from the Roosters, again, you know, like one of the pioneering forwards, and he looks like a pretty hard bugger too, by all accounts.
Peter Moir.
Yeah, well, he was an intermediary, and without him, rugby league may not have started, because he was apparently the one who said the comment, why don't we put a team together to play these? And
okay.
I went, yeah, okay, why don't we?
Wow.
And yet he was, even though he was a major figure in the start of the game, when he was selected for the 1908 Kangaroo Tour, he didn't get a look in. All the blokes who were his mates, and Giltinan was the manager, he only got about four or five games out of the 45 that they played. So he was very upset and came home, and he gave it away within a few years. But he died fairly young, you know. He didn't make it to the 1920s. So.
Pearce.
Yeah, well, Sandy Pearce, obviously, yep, one of the greats of the game, and the oldest player to play for Australia. He played for Australia in these games, and then still went on the 1921 Kangaroo Tour, and it was only a broken leg then on that tour, courtesy of his good mate Frank Burge, that ended his playing day. So,
wow. Can.
Billy Can from South Sydney, yes, a controversial figure in some ways, but obviously a wonderful player, and he was looked on as the first running lock and the father of that, I suppose, the Johnny Raper, Ron Coote line of lock forwards who were a link between attack for the backs and the forwards.
And Graves.
Yeah, Bob Graves. he was, again, one of the Balmain pioneers, and he had a few problems when he came across because they didn't want to give him his fare back to Sydney. He was on tour with the Balmain side, but some of the other players were going to go on strike if they didn't. So, and then a lot of those other players came across within a year or two anyway.
One more, Brackenberg.
Brackenridge, sorry. He was from Eastern Suburbs, and he played for Australia in 1908, but then he went to Queensland and played the rest of his career up there. He was one of those who helped get the game going in Queensland when that started in 1909, and played up there for about two or three years. And I think his father was an official with the Roosters when they formed in 1908 as well.
And that's a 15-man squad, and appropriately named referee, G. Boss.
George Boss. And yeah, George Boss, he's one of my favourite figures actually in the in those pioneering days, because he is involved in these games. He then referees in the first games in 1908, and he's appointed as manager of the Māori team that comes across in 1908. And they had all sorts of arguments with Giltinan, and Giltinan was by no means a perfect figure. And when Boss sided with the Māori against the New South Wales Rugby League, he became persona non grata with the league. And whether he was just that pissed off that he walked away, or whether they just punted him, so he was... Basically, by the end of 1909, he's gone out of the game. And an amazing figure, you know, because he played, him and Ted Hooper really started the Referees Association.
Wow. So important, you don't have refs, you don't have a game.
Yeah, so New Zealand win this first game, 12-8, in front of 20,000 people. So as we say, the second game was a Wednesday fixture. There's only 4,000 people there, and New Zealand win that one, 19-5. There's a few new players for the New South Welshmen. Jimmy Devereaux from North Sydney, who went on to play in England as well and had a wonderful career with Hull. Dave Brown, the first of the four Dave Browns who have played first grade rugby league. And this guy was from the Roosters. And again, he's a bit of a tragic story. He was killed in a train accident where he was decapitated in before the First World War. Pony Halloway. Deserves his own episode. Harry Dosser-Glanville from North Sydney, who was, again, a wonderful player in the early days, but he lived to a ripe old age. So he's always in those reunion photos you see of the pioneers in the 50s and that, up until, I think it was in the 60s, I think Rosenfeld was the last of them to actually go. And the last two, Alf Bullocky Dobbs, wonderful nickname from Balmain.
These names are fantastic. There's no Jadens or Cadens or anything like that. There's Alf, Henry, Charlie...
And the last one, Tedder Courtney, who was a wonderful player by all accounts. He was actually with St George. He was going to play with them in 1908, but they didn't get a team going. So he plays with Newtown in 1908, then with Wests in 1909, North Sydney in 1910, and then goes back to Western Suburbs in 1911 and plays for the best part of another 14 years with them, to the extent that he's in 1924, his final season, he's joined in the first grade team by his son, and he's the only man to ever play in a first grade fixture in the same team as his son. So,
that's incredible.
Some amazing pioneers there that feature in there in that second game. The third game on the Saturday, there's another 8,000 people there. Jim Abercrombie, or Mescal, he went by both names, but he comes into the team. He was a big, burly front rower, and he also went on that first Kangaroo Tour in 1908, as did nearly all these blokes.
So it's a clean sweep to New Zealand.
Yeah, but the benefits of the game went far beyond the results. So the legacy of it really is that they've secured Daly, who's the star player.
Marquee signing.
Yes, exactly. So the sort of franchise player you could build some the whole club around.
They literally built the code around him.
Absolutely. And he goes off and tours with this New Zealand team. And even though he didn't get paid, supposedly, for playing in these matches, I mean, the players got some expenses, that the New Zealanders all had to stump up their own money to pay for the tour. So, and that was £50 in they were all required to put, which is a large amount of money. Money back then. And the story is that Giltinan put that money up for him, and that was the guarantee to for him to come across, because which suggests that all this all may have been lined up before he signed on the dotted line just for these games. And Sean Fagan, in his wonderful book, wrote The Rugby Rebellion, which tells the story of all this in greater detail than we can go into here. But he alludes to that sort of stuff, because Daly, obviously, within a week, he's gone. After these games, he's gone with the Kiwis. Yeah. They've gone to England. And he goes on to be one of the stars, if not the star, of the team. And the Kiwis had a wonderful team. They had two of those 1905 All Blacks, as I say. Massa Johnson was in that team. George Smith was in the team. And then the New Zealanders are captained by the wonderfully named Hercules Wright. Bumper Wright was his nickname.
Fantastic.
But you've got the likes of Lance Todd, who their Lance Todd medal is named after. Jum Turtle, who was a wonderful player with St Helens, but then... and owned his own pub and gave it up to enlist in the First World War and was killed in action. I mean, you've got everything to live for, mate. and the Wynyard brothers, Rowe, you know, like there's a lot of good names there, apart from Baskerville himself and Callum, who they barely played. You know, they took more managerial roles too.
So Messenger goes and plays for New Zealand.
Yes.
Despite not being a New Zealander.
Well, it was the Australasian principle, it's a bit like split ends or far.
Yeah, that's true. Russell Crowe, you know. And
so, and he's the star. Yeah. And so he comes back and, you know, like... and because he's done so well, then there's also the basis for an Australian tour to follow the next year. Yeah. But all those guys who were in those pioneering games, they've gone off, they've started the clubs, pretty much club meetings. Even though the clubs don't have their formal meetings until January, these guys have already been suspended by the rugby union. So the whole question of who's the first club is fairly moot point, because these guys are already doing behind the scenes and obviously working on who getting other players over to come and join them. Because initially they thought it might just be a 9-day wonder, was the phrase to use. But obviously, the fact that we're still here 120 years later shows that the legacy lives on. And then, so you've got that premiership legacy as well, but it's also the start of international football.
It is.
Because New Zealand and Australia, and then when they got to England, the Poms all of a sudden realised that, having been on their own since 1895, hang on, we've got the basis here of something that's going to be much bigger in the future. And it took a long time for it to get much bigger, but you look at the Rugby League International Federation these days and the number of nations who are a part of it, either full members or affiliates, and it's astounding. And the growth that is there is just, it's something to warm the cockles of the heart.
But also, too, it's just a completely different world today. You have no internet. You have no major sort of news sources. It's all about touring. It's all about getting the product out there in person. And the travel time. Enormous travel time.
Yeah. And so the Kiwis, the Baskerville's team, they did well out of the tour, and they all made money. I think it was about £350 return per player. So, you know, that's a fair whack.
That
would allow you to pay off a house in
Sydney.
How long
were they away for?
The best part of 9 months. Because when they come back, they play test matches, they tour here. And that's the tour is marked by tragedy right at the end, because Baskerville dies in Brisbane before they get back to New Zealand. And so some of the players take his body back there, and the remainder of the party has to stay here to fulfil the schedule, which would have been very, very difficult for them. Different time. And we owe a lot to those New Zealanders as much as we do to those New South Wales pioneers. So,
as you said, that's where it all starts. The legacy of those games is just amazing.
Yeah. And we're still here talking about it 120 years later. So maybe it is still relevant.
You can contact us on rugbyleaguerookwood@hotmail.com, or you can find us on the Facebook and other social media outlets. I'm Matt Hunt.
I'm Terry Williams.
Thanks a lot for joining us. And always remember, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme.
What?